It's the Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Good morning and welcome to the show. The Back Nine Boys is brought to you by Bridgestone Golf. Play the Tour B ball with Mindset Technology. By the club at Sea Palms. By PXG, you've never played like this before. By RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community. By Stitch Golf, dress your game. And by my favorite, CJ's Italian Restaurant in the Village, voted best pizza, known for their deep dish and thin crust and much, much, much more. Check out their full menu at cjsitalianrestaurant.com. Our guest this morning from the Georgia State Golf Association is Brian Nelson. And Brian, good morning and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rich. Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, your topic is very apropos because, you know, this is the time of the year where people want to get better. They want to lower their handicap, which to me seems difficult at times. So first off, what is a golf handicap and how do you establish a golf handicap?
Well, if you're a golfer that plays at a particular golf course, you can either ride through the golf course or you can also join online. We do have an opportunity for golfers to join online if they don't have a particular course that they call home. And the handicap basically results from scores that are shot based on the tees that are being played on that particular round. Each round is when they finish, they post their score, and then the next day they'll have an update to their handicap index. And after a round is played, they create a differential. So ultimately, when a golfer's posted 20 scores, the lowest eight of those differentials, which again is computed with the course range slope rating of the tees that are played for that round, and that's all done in the system. So golfers don't have to memorize that or know how that math works.
Okay. How does it accommodate for weather, or does it? How does it accommodate for age, or does it?
Okay, for weather, in the middle of the night or after, you know, the scores are posted, the scores looked at, and there's an algorithm where if the scores are particularly higher or lower than normal, they would adjust the differential for that round on that played at that golf course for all the different tees.
Okay.
So if there's bad weather and everybody's posting higher scores, they will adjust it accordingly a little bit. And at the same token, if scores are real low, maybe the hole locations were set pretty easy. Golf course might have played a little bit shorter with wind or something like that. That was an advantage. Then scores would be adjusted accordingly.
Okay. I did find when I moved up in tees, trying to play the appropriate tees, that it was my handicap went up right away based on the fact that I moved up to the forward tees.
It should have gone down. Because the course rating and slope rating would be lower.
Yeah, it did not. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe I should move back up again. I don't know. Anyway, that was always a question. So does it fluctuate much during the year? So how does it readjust? Does it take the lower eight each certain period of time?
It's the lowest eight of the most recent 20 scores. So once you establish a history, the 20 scores might have been played within the last year. It depends on, you know, maybe a month for some golfers out there that are playing every day.
Right.
They'll post that many scores. And there's safeguards in the system not to allow a handicap to climb too high. With the research that's been done, there's a soft cap and a hard cap in place. So if a handicap goes up three shots compared to the handicap index on that round that's played, then it would only go up half that amount. It would be a 50% increase. It wouldn't go all the way up. And then conversely, it would, in any given year or 365-day period, it can't go more than five strokes higher than what your index, the low handicap index was for that period of time. So if you're an 8.1, for instance, the highest the system would allow you to go would be a 13.1.
Okay. And then the lowest it would make you go would be the same going down?
No, it allows you to get as good and play as well as you want to. So it can, you know, it can generally go down lower as well. Chances are, I don't think it's going to, because again, that lowest data, most recent 20, those eight are going to have to be real, real low compared to what's already been posted by that golfer for it to change much.
Okay, so let me see if I understand. Every 20 scores, it takes the lower eight and adjusts accordingly. Now, is that every month, or does that depend on how many times the person is playing per week or per month?
It's a rolling 20 score. So once 20 scores are posted, if there's less than 20 scores in the golfer's queue, then it takes a portion of those. It just takes a straight average of those scores. So ultimately, with 20 posted, the lowest eight are averaged to determine your handicap index, and then you apply that to the table to see what, depending on the slope rating of the golf course you're playing that day, then that turns the handicap index into a course handicap.
Gotcha. Well, it's always been fascinating to me. You know, the guys that I play with, it's like, man, my handicap went up and I thought I was playing well. And I don't know, it seems like they're playing the same tees, but the guys that I play with say it goes up faster than it can come down.
Yeah, they with this research that's been done, a golfer shoots his plays to his handicap about 25% of the time. So basically, okay. One out of every four rounds. And you know, as golfers, we want to play that perfect round every time we go out to play. And I think back to Ben Hogan, where he might have hit one or two good shots around that he thought were acceptable for his game.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that makes more sense. One out of four rounds, golfers play to their handicap.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So that is a big reason why golfers in Georgia are joining the Georgia State Golf Association. So tell us how to join.
Again, you can go to a golfer can go to the golf course and say they want to join the GSJA, which ultimately would give them the GIN number that they can use to post scores and track their handicaps. There's also a great mobile app that they can use. It has GPS built into it. It's free. It comes with a membership. And you can also keep track of your foursomes, too. You can post. You can just keep track right on the phone there with your scores. At the end of the round, you just post the scores, and then your score gets posted for the score. The other three rounds get routed to the golfers, and then they can post from there as well.
Okay. And tell us more of some of the member benefits to join the GSGA.
Yes, we've got a list of about 30 perks that are online, and that's ever evolving. Our team does a nice job as far as getting discounts and things like that for mainly golf companies, but there's some other companies that may surprise you as well. But that's ever evolving, and we have a full list of those at www.gsj.org. It also comes with a Golf Digest magazine subscription, as well as our Golf Georgia magazine, which is in print 6 months out of the year, and then every other month it's done digitally.
That's a tough word sometimes, isn't it?
I was just going to say that three times fast.
Say it once fast.
Yeah, pretty much. I had to slow myself down.
Yeah.
So those are the just a few of the perks and benefits of being a GSJ member. There's also play day opportunities where they can have access to a golf course to play that you might normally not get on, and have an opportunity to play your own ball and just shoot a score. And then there's also competition, too. We have a rules competition that runs about 150 events a year for all different skill levels, men, women, senior men, senior women. There's mixed team competition as well. We have our state AM and state mid-AM competitions. We run USGA qualifiers. So there's just a lot of tournaments happening in our rules competition department. And plus, we have a junior golfer. Our GSJ junior tour is thriving. And two of the three kids that are from Georgia that are competing, that competed in the drive, chip, and putt, were from our junior tour.
Is it amazing to you how fast the women and the junior players are growing, and especially in your membership with GSJA?
Yeah, it's great. It's great to see the kids out playing. And we have a youth on course program that allows them to play certain golf courses for $5 a round with their parents. So it's just a great way to keep them involved. And the women too, there's more women playing these days. And I was actually at a Golf Course of Macon helping them run a tournament a couple weeks ago. And I couldn't believe the number of lefties that were out there. They
really?
Had like one lefty in every foursome. It was amazing.
And it used to be where you couldn't even get clubs left-handed in most of the manufacturers. And now it's obviously more common.
Right. Yeah, you had to either switch or have, you know, almost be willed to set a left-handed clubs. It was probably harder to get left-handed clubs than it was to get into the Masters back in the day.
Yeah, I was watching one of our pros here at Sea Island, and he plays right-handed. And then he said, I'm going to play one ball right-handed and one ball left-handed. And I said, really? And he went out there. His swing was just as good left-handed as it was right-handed. I was totally amazed.
It's interesting. And also looking at your swing in the mirror, to where it would turn a right-handed person to a left-handed person would be interesting to see as well.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, isn't that how Phil Mickelson learned how to play golf, is that he was looking in the mirror and thought he was a lefty?
I think that's what happened, right? And he's normally right-handed. You see a lot of left-handed. I'm left-handed myself. The only thing I do right-handed is, you know, golf and scissors, and I eat with both hands. So that really doesn't count too much.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody admit to eating with both hands.
Well, it's a radio. It's a radio show.
I know. I had a guy once who said he could dribble with both hands, right and left. He was amphibious.
him and Yogi Berra, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to the Masters, and this will be playing over the Masters weekend. And you've been there many, many, many times. And this year, due to your surgery that you had, you're going to sit at number three. Why'd you pick number three?
I really haven't spent that much time on that golf course, on that part of the golf course. And I know number three is a hole you can see right, you know, all the way down. It's a fairly straight hole.
Right.
It's a short hole, so you're going to see shots coming in. A lot of wedges will be coming in. The occasional guy may try to go to the green and go for the green off the tee if the tees are up a little bit. So just thought it'd be an interesting look. And I may end up walking, depending on how I'm feeling, I may end up getting around a little bit further, but I definitely won't walk in foul groups. I mean, back in the day, I used to walk 36. And those days are done. And with the crowds and everything, it's hard to move around. You almost have to really just kind of pick a spot and enjoy it. And I'm hoping I can see some of number four. That's a really good par three as well. And you know, seeing some of those shots coming in there would be good too.
I talked to Dr. Bob Jones, grandson of Bobby Jones. He said, when we talked a little bit about the course that his grandfather designed, that there really are not even lies on the golf course. I mean, in the fairways, it's either slanted or it's up or it's down. That amazes me.
Yeah, when you get there in person, you see the slopes and everything. It's just it's unbelievable. And these guys, you know, they can persevere and just and play well and put the scores up that are just amazing to me.
You know, and most of the crowd goes to Amen Corner, or they go to, 15, 16. I know the first time I went, we put our chairs at 16, walked around all morning, and then went back to 16. It was very fun. I mean, very enjoyable. And just to see those guys play any of the holes the way that they play it is just incredible.
Yeah, I'm warming up to the fact that just sitting there and watching groups come through, we'll get there early enough to be able to get out there. And actually, we're going to have our chairs placed. One of my friends that I'm going with, he has a sheriff that plays golf with at his course, and he is a volunteer on the fourth hole. So he's going to plant our chairs out there for us on the third hole there. So
it is truly who you know, right?
Exactly. So I'm hoping for a good spot there. Maybe he can put me, maybe in the middle of the green. That would be helpful as well.
Wouldn't that be fun? All right. Well, I appreciate it. GSGA.com or no, .org.
.org.
We need to go to join the GSGA. And Brian, as always, get well quick. Enjoy the Masters. And thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Rich. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Hey, this is Coach Chris Hack, the University of Georgia. You're listening to the Back Nine Boys, and it's a great way to listen to golf.
Welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. We're with Todd Graves, Todd Graves Golf. Todd, it's been a while, but it's great to have you back on the Back Nine Boys. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah, great to be here.
So, Mo Norman obviously, with the feeling of greatness. This has given you an opportunity to expand this single plane swing. Explain the single plane swing to our listeners.
Yeah, so when people set up to a golf ball and you look at the average conventional golfer and what's been taught in golf instruction forever is, and it's you know, you watch TV, you may not even see this, but what you're really seeing is people are, they call it the athletic position, where people set up, they let their arms hang down below their shoulders, and then they grab the golf club. And so you see what you have basically two different things happening there. You have the arms coming down, and you have the club, an angle between the wrists and the club on a secondary plane. We call that a two-plane address position. Now, this is what is pretty much taught everywhere. There's different variations of standing too close to the ball. Some people are closer to the ball than others, but the arms are on a separate line than the club. The problem with that address is when people swing the golf club and you're moving this, you know, 3 foot stick around your body with weight on the end, is when you swing it around your body, the club will, the mass of the club is trying to align with whatever is moving it, which is your arms. So all of a sudden everything starts trying to line up. So what happens in effect is the guys who set up with their hands really low and the club on a secondary plane start standing up and they start lifting their body up to allow for this basically a natural occurring motion of the club and the arms to line up. And then everybody ends up at a higher position at impact. So the arms and club will be higher at impact. So they'll start the arms and hands low and impact higher. And so if you start looking at everybody and you start looking at impact, you know, everybody's pretty much impacting in very similar positions, the body position, the arm positions, the club position, but they start in a position that's really not even close to where they're going to impact the golf ball. And as we know, the most important moment of the swing is the moment of impact. So right. the question becomes, you know, what is the easiest way to get impact? You know, the question shouldn't be what does Tiger Woods do, or what does John Rahm do, or, you know, that shouldn't be our question. Our question should be, hey, for what's the best way to take this club and get it to impact consistently in the easiest way? So if you look at Mo Norman and Mo, my mentor, and what he did with a single plane swing, is he put the club and the arms all into the same exact plane, the same line. So he lifted the arms up into a single plane. Well, if you look at what that is, that's the exact plane that you're going to impact, both the arms and the club. So now you're starting and impacting on the same plane. So that's the first thing you see when you'd see me or Mo or a single plane person hit a golf ball. You'd see them look like their arms are reaching out a little bit more, and the club and the arms would be into an alignment. But there's a little more going on than that, because when you do this, when you put your body in that position to where everything's lined up with the club, you've simplified the entire mechanical motion of the body. Less rotation needs to happen, less rotation of the hands, less lifting of the body, less stress on the back, less bending of the body, which causes people to have problems with their lower back pain and things. Right. So you know, I get into the world of biomechanics quite a bit, which, you know, people say it's complicated, but it's really not. You know, it's really saying, okay, listen, what's the easiest way to hit a ball on the ground with a 3 foot stick? And that's what golf needs to be looked at. And so when you look at Mo Norman swing, and the first thing you see when you see Mo Norman swing a golf club, or you see me swing a golf club, is like, wow, it looks like he's reaching for the ball and the ball looks a long way away. But I'm really Mo, and we just start the club exactly where we're going to impact, and everything in the swing gets easier.
So in this simple process, and you know, you say it's perfect for older players, we amateur golfers get into this trying to be in the perfect position with, you know, our bodies and our backswings, and we end up swaying or, you know, doing all these other things that we make golf more complicated than it really needs to be. So this single plane golf and the swing makes it much easier for older players, and actually anybody, to hit the ball more consistently.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, I now have a couple of business partners in one at the Texas Back Institute and one at Cedars-Sinai Back Institute. These guys were promoting my methodology of swinging a golf club long before they were my business partners. Matter of fact, they became my business partners because they were recommending my swing teaching to all their customers and their clients that were having back problems. And so it is really good. It's a really good way to swing a golf club for anybody who has back problems, but it really comes down to it's easier on the body. And because there's less movement going on, you're in a more natural position of the body. You know, people have always said that the golf swing is an unnatural movement. Well, it really is a very unnatural movement if you continue to set up in the way that golf is teaching. And I call the address position that they teach in on the PGA teaching manual the one mistake, because they start out with a flawed address position that's biomechanically difficult, and then we got to make compensations in motion to get to impact. And those compensations are the ones that we get injured. We have to rotate. We have to move out of the way. We have to straighten our legs. We have to lift our body as we're going down, striking a golf ball. And that complexity of movement, you know, people learn to do it. You look at guys like any guy play on tour, they've learned to adequately accomplish and solve the problem of that mistake. But 55 to 58% of golfers who play golf, if they play golf in their lifetime, will have back pain because of that. And so that's half. And look at Rory McIlroy, and there's been a bunch of guys on tour, Will Zalatoris. These guys are young guys, and they're having back issues, and they're putting stress on their body. And that's a function of the position they're starting the body in. They're just too close to the golf ball. And the physics of the golf swing with the speeds and requirements of swinging that club are creating stresses in the body. And all that really can be eliminated. And so that's one side of it. But the other side of it is that, you know, I could show you right now, just sitting at your desk, that your body has joints and muscles, and your arm has a certain range of motion. So every joint in your body has a range of motion. And so I would pose this question to somebody. I would say, look, what if I could put your body into a position where if I set it up in a certain way and put your arms and hands at certain orientations and rotations, that I could actually use the way your body is designed to hit a golf ball? In other words, I'm going to use the range of motion of your wrist. I'm going to use the range of motion of your shoulder. I'm not going to fight against it. I'm going to put you in a position to where you're basically just swinging naturally around your body, and your body's naturally squaring the face up. And I can do that. And that's what Mo figured out. He somehow, and I'm not exactly sure how, but he somehow, when in his natural genius and the way he was wired in his brain, figured out a natural way to position the body to hit a golf ball. And so that's a really fun thing I've been able to really help people with, is just say, hey, we can make this so much easier. We just got to change the way your body is positioned a little bit. We got to get you from away from the ball. We got to put your tilt. I've got to orient your arm to a certain rotation, and I can get you swinging away naturally.
So how long does it take for you to work with someone in order to have them buy into the single plane swing?
Well, the buy-in has to be there before I work with them, to be honest with you. I kind of reverse that a little bit because, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's an important thing to talk about because, you know, I had a guy's wife the other day. I gave him some instruction. He flew into town from South Carolina, and his wife came in with him. And so I put him on video. And one of the things that I make sure I really do with people is I give them a measurable system to be able to learn it themselves. And so when I put people on, let's say my video system down there, and I'm showing them their swing, I show them how to exactly what needs to happen in their movement and with the plane line. And I have a couple ways I do that. And so I put this gentleman on the video and I put the plane line up, and I said, look, I'm going to show you what this exactly a perfect swing should feel like. And I had him basically, he was taking the club way inside. He was coming down way from the inside. He was hooking the golf ball. He had all these patterns. So I made him swing perfectly, right up and down the plane. And he turns to me and he says, that feels like I'm coming way over the top. And I'm like, well, you're not. It's perfectly on plane swing. That's exactly the way you got to swing the golf club. And he says, Todd, he goes, I've been swinging this way forever, like way from the inside. I go, I get it. I totally get it. So what happens is people have they've built in neurological patterns.
Right.
And so when I came out of the lesson, and his wife, I worked with him for a couple hours, and I come out and his wife is there. And his wife said, Todd, listen, if this swing is so easy, why does he have such a hard time learning it? And I said, because no one comes to me at a clean slate. Everybody comes to me with years and years of programming, and I am reprogramming brains. I'm rewiring circuitry. And so the answer to your question is, how many are you willing to go through the repetitive process of doing it correctly over and over again and rewire yourself. And so how long does that take? Well, some people can accomplish it really fast because they're like me. They're super compulsive and they'll take it on and
right,
I'm working.
right.
Yeah. And some people, if they want to practice once a week and not practice, they'll never get it. You know, they're never going to get it. So it's kind of a question that comes down to the commitment level of the person that's learning it. So that's why I say you got to kind of reverse it. When a person's fully committed, they'll learn it pretty quickly. When a person's kind of like, I don't know if this is going to work for me, and they're still trying to use their old swing, but maybe get a few tips from me, I don't really go through that process very much. I try not to give too many tips. I try to rebuild if I can.
Right. And you know, we're in this society of convenience. We want it now, you know, and you're right. Whenever you try and change their thinking of how they address the ball, how they come through the ball, it doesn't happen overnight because of all the times that and years that they've been playing the way that they played.
Yeah. You know, Mo, when I spent time with Mo and a lot of things that Mo would talk to me about, you know, that weren't swing related, we're really, really more on the mental side of how I should approach my making changes. And he would often say to me, which I didn't, by the way, I didn't understand at the time. Sometimes he would say things to me and I wouldn't know what he meant for years
right.
after he said it to me.
Right.
But he said to me, there's a couple things he said to me. When I first met him, he said, you got to believe in yourself. And that was kind of the first, that was like the first thing I said, Mo, how do I learn to be better than you? Or how can I learn to be as good as you? And he said, you got to believe in yourself. So, I mean, I kind of understood what that meant, but I kind of didn't understand. I just kind of took it for, okay, confidence, whatever.
Right.
And then he also said this in parallel to that. He said, you have to use your imagination. And I didn't really understand that. I didn't understand what he meant by use your imagination. Well, as I used to, you know, I do a lot of writing about Mo and that's time I spent with him and what he taught me and things. And I finally, probably about 2 years ago, really recognized exactly what he meant by use your imagination. And what he meant by that was you have to envision yourself being what you want to be before you can be it. So in other words, if I'm going to learn the single plane swing and master single plane swing, I've got to actually see myself swinging on a single plane.
Right.
Right? I can't just go out there and go, I hope I do this right. I've got to actually in my mind say, I can see myself being successful doing this, which makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, why would you do anything that you can't imagine yourself? Why would you go buy a car that you didn't want to drive, right? Why would you do anything that you can't see yourself doing? So, but that's a big deal because when I can see myself actually doing it, then I aspire and I'll do whatever I need to do to get to that vision.
Right.
And so when I teach people and I instruct them, they will not leave my studio without making a perfect swing. Number one, I can show them you can do it. Like, look, I've seen you do it. You did it right here. You just did it perfectly in front of me, right?
Right.
And number two, they see themselves doing it. So now it's not hope anymore. They're not hoping for a better swing. They've done it. So that is probably the most important part of my teaching process is giving somebody the visual that they're doing it. And now they just do what they got to do to get there. Without that, what they're going to do is they're going to go to the range. They're going to hit a couple of bad shots. They're not going to get the result they want. They're going to go, this doesn't work.
Right.
And that has
right.
nothing to do. That has nothing to do with look, how many times have you made a really good golf swing, hit a bad shot?
Several.
I do it all the time. Right?
Oh, heck yeah.
Right. I mean, so it really, you know, the result of the ball is just, that's a byproduct of a really good motion.
Right.
And so if you can get a person to envision themselves aspiring and making a perfect swing, and you're like, look at the swing plane of that swing you just made. It's perfectly back on plane. It comes down on plane. You impact on plane. You finish on plane. Look at how good that swing was. It clicks to them. And they're like, wow, I can do this. You know,
yeah.
Let's keep doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give us the website, Todd, so our listeners can go to it.
Yeah, I just finished a book called The Intelligent Golf Swing. I'm really excited about the book. It just came out a few months ago. It launches on Amazon on the 14th of April. It's actually, you can pre-order it now. But if you want to go learn about the book, it's theintelligentgolfswing.com.
And your website for Todd Graves
Golf? The website for Graves Golf is just gravesgolf.com. You can go on there and see where we host schools. You can learn all about our programs. You can even see the stuff about how we fit golf clubs. We have special ways of reverse engineering clubs for the single plane. But that's us all on our website.
Got it. Todd, it's always a pleasure. I won't wait this long to get back with you again.
Thanks Please for, do.
Thanks
Please
for
do.
The info. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Thank you.
right.
Take care. This is VJ Trolio, Director of Instruction at Frederica Golf Club, and you are listening to the Back Nine Boys.
Welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles, and we are with Ron Green, senior writer with Global Golf Post. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. It's a good time of year to talk about golf.
You betcha, especially last weekend. What a wonderful win for Gary Woodland. I know a lot of people were praying for that. He probably was as well, but you were there. Tell me about what you felt and how the press conference went with Gary.
I was not actually on property, but I've been around Gary so much through the years. And
yeah.
I'm like everybody else. I mean, it just, you just, the emotion, the feeling, just the, you know, the pure human joy that came with what he accomplished because of, I mean, if you were before all he's been through with the brain issue, if you took a poll of the best guys, most popular like people on the tour, he might have been number one already. And now yeah. this, you know, it's such a, you know, an emotional layering, and to hear him from 2 years, 3 years ago when he started this journey and made it public, to even last week when he's still fighting these symptoms, and, you know, telling the story of being Friday afternoon, having being triggered again and crying in the scoring room afterwards. He's dealing with so much, and he's done it so gracefully. And, you know, I go back to seeing him on Full Swing a couple years ago, and he's going into a, you know, a scan, and he's letting the cameras in there. It's just, he's been so sort of willing to share this journey with the public. I think that has drawn people into him. And, you know, I mean, he's good enough. He won the 2019 U.S. Open. He's won five times on the tour, but this is different.
Yeah. PTSD is totally different. A lot of people, I mean, they know about it. There's been a lot of publicity about it, a lot of stories, but when you go through it or you know somebody personally that's going through it, it creates a whole different feeling and a whole different story. You knew him prior to this, the brain surgery and everything else. But since then, have you sensed that he was going through PTSD?
The little bit of time I've been around him, you know, he's been nice. Our interactions, strangely, or for whatever reason, tend to be about college basketball because obviously he's a giant Kansas fan.
Gosh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, loves that. And I went to the University of North Carolina. And so that's sort of the common ground. We talk about that. And I know because I talked to him, I haven't actually gotten to talk to him since then, but he was finally making his first trip to Chapel Hill to see the Jayhawks play late last year. And I tried to find him a couple of times earlier this year when I just missed our paths didn't cross, but you know, I know how much that means to him and what a passion is it. And I guess both of us find our programs in interesting spots these days.
Well, and you have known him for several years, and as you said, he's a Jayhawks fan and you're a Tar Heel fan. Unfortunately, both of you are out of the tournament, but at least you didn't lose like Duke did at that last second. My gosh, what a talking about being a basketball fan.
Yeah, I was, in my previous life as a sports writer for the Charlotte Observer, I was sitting courtside when Christian Laettner hit the shot to beat Kentucky. I mean,
wow.
it was funny because, you know, even though it was 1.4 seconds or whatever it was, I remember sitting there and had time from the time Grant Hill threw the pass to Laettner catching it to think he's going to make this shot. And watching the end of the Connecticut game, as soon as the ball went back outside to the guy who hit the shot, I just thought, this is bottoms right here. He's getting ready to hit the same thing. And it's just, I mean, what an iconic moment. I mean, it is one we will remember. I'm the rare North Carolina fan who doesn't dislike Duke basketball. So I was a little pained for the Blue Devils there.
I got you. Well, let's jump back to Gary a little bit. So here he is coming into this tournament, a lot of pressure. He has the lead first round, second round, third round. He's, you know, just right there. What a Sunday for him. And as you said, he was triggered on Friday.
Yeah. And he just, you know, he's talked about how he's been able to sort of get his focus on the golf course. And you know, he'd worked with Butch Harmon for a while. It started with Randy Smith, and he's gone back to Randy Smith, Scotty Scheffler's coach. And Gary said Sunday night that his game is more complete now than it's ever been. And he could see signs that he'd put himself, you know, on leaderboards and hasn't had quite the big breakthrough. But, you know, to just go do that. And when he talked about, did the interview with Rex Hoggard, I guess, at the Players' Championship, it talked about the PTSD and how it felt like he unburdened himself a little bit. He didn't have to hide that part of it. And I'm certainly no psychologist, but you can't help but see a correlation that maybe once that got away from it, now I can go fully be myself. You know, it's maybe a different self than he was 2 or 3 years ago, but it's just, you know, what a wonderful story. And now it gets him in Augusta. And I think, you know, we're down there next week. That's going to be, he's going to be one of the people who, one of the characters in the story because of what he's done.
And you know the crowd is going to be definitely behind him, and the crowd is going to definitely want him to go all the way, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I would not be surprised if Augusta puts him in a very sort of glamorous grouping as they go out there the first couple of days, because I think you know, he's got such, you know, this wave of appreciation and respect and admiration that it's easy to get pretty emotional at Augusta anyway. And I think he will be certainly part of that.
And even with the win that Gary Woodland had, the PTSD continues. So, I mean, he's still having to do work to get back to a state where he's not triggered as often as he might be.
Yeah, and he's talked about it. You know, one of his lines is, I've been determined not to let this thing in my head win. And he's had a lot of help along the way. And he said he has talked to a number of veterans who are dealing with this, and said he gets the same message every time: you can't do this alone. And so he has got a support group, and, you know, the tour has sort of built some security protocols to help him when he's on the golf course. So I think, you know, when he gets to Augusta, I think if he didn't already sense it, he will feel that there's even more people, you know, along to support him.
Well, let's just wish him the best, and that he plays the best and has a clear head and has a good week. That would be another great story.
That really
speaking
would.
Speaking of stories, any recent updates on a guy from Jupiter that a lot of people follow? And anytime he's in the news, it becomes top of the news about Tiger and the accident.
I mean, no real update other than what Tiger supplied with his statement that he is stepping away for a little while and going to deal with some challenges in his life. I mean, I think it's just from where we were a week or so ago to today as we're talking. I mean, he was playing TGL. He was having fun. You know, you see, he seemed to really enjoy being the captain of his Jupiter Lynx team down there. And then he finally gets back in. You know, he's playing competitive golf again and teasing the possibility of Augusta. I don't know that any of us expected if he showed up and played there that he was going to win. But, you know, we've gotten so little Tiger on the golf course the last 4 or 5 years that, you know, the fact that he kept it open and, you know, he's got the seniors golf he could play if he wanted to. And then suddenly the Friday afternoon news alert is just like, wow, not again. And, you know, once you found out nobody was hurt, but all that has come with this. And I don't think any of us can properly imagine probably the discomfort he lives with every day, given, what is it, he said, told the officers 20 surgeries. I mean, lucky to still have his leg from the accident in Los Angeles. Right. All the back surgeries, all the pain that comes with it. I think he is, he's grappling with a lot. And he holds himself to such a high standard competitively and still, you know, with his commitment to the gym and commitment to trying to get his golf game back. There's a lot there. And, you know, and throw on top of that, all that he has taken on with the PGA Tour. I would never have guessed 10 or 15 years ago that Tiger would be one of the governmental leaders of the PGA Tour. I didn't think that was sort of in his future, but I think it speaks to how he cares about the game and the tour. And you know, probably some of it affects his legacy, wanting the tour to be as strong as possible. And he's front and center with this future competitions committee as it sort of reimagines the PGA Tour. So I don't know if him stepping away and Brian Rolapp's statement indicated Tiger was not going to be involved for a little bit, if that slows the process or what. But, you know, it was a giant's tail start to finish with Tiger to begin with. And it just, you know, one more chapter, you know, you've got the sort of the three parts. There's the golf success, there's the injuries he's dealt with, and then there's the sort of subsequent drama that has come for all this. And
right,
I think everybody just hopes he can get through this and be all right.
Yeah, and it's been drama since 2008. I mean, there's just been many things that have happened. But you mentioned Brian Rolapp and his talk and his relationship with Tiger. And what are your thoughts and what have you heard from some of the players on the tour about Brian's future plans for the PGA Tour?
Well, I think they've been pretty aggressive, you know, reimagination of it, I suppose. Yeah. I think as Brian Rolapp indicated at the Players Championship, maybe you can't turn the ship around as dramatically and quickly as he thought when he came in. There's a lot of, you know, sponsor deals, media deals, all this stuff. I think he's on the right track to trying to maximize what the PGA Tour can be. I think when he used the word scarcity last fall, he had us all thinking they're going to go down to 23, 24 tournaments. What's going to happen to the rest? He sort of clarified that in March. And I think they're trying to get as many big events as they can. I do think they're working toward this two-track tour where you're going to have this one level of tour events and then this secondary level. But, you know, we sort of focus on, among the things we focused on was maybe they're not going to start till just before the Super Bowl. We found out now that the American Express is going to be played the whatever third week of January next year. Maybe the radical change is not coming. I think it's going to be phased in over time. You know, I think the understanding what the media rights are going to look like down the line, if, you know, he was so instrumental in what the NFL did, and now the NFL is coming back apparently to the table a little early to renegotiate its deals. And that's going to trigger what happens throughout sports. You know, what is it? Rolapp said, I may get the numbers wrong. There's $30 billion in media rights on all sports. The NFL had $12 billion of that last time and is looking to double it. Well, and it doesn't leave a lot for everybody else, but I did a long story on him in January, talked to a lot of the key people in television and in the business of golf and sports. And to a person, they talked about Brian Rolapp being so good at taking the big picture and seeing it and being able to sort of pull it all together. And, you know, like when he did the NFL media deal, there were five individual contracts, maybe more. With one of the persons said, it was like he was landing five planes at one time and did it flawlessly.
Right.
So I think it's good that we're finally has somebody from the outside, bringing a new perspective. My guess is it's not going to be, you know, he's not going to change the color from green to red. You know, it's going to still be the PGA Tour, but I think they're going to be, you know, with the investment from the Strategic Sports Group, I think the tour wants to create some more of its own tournaments. I think it may use some of that money to go into the bigger markets. They talk about New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, some of those places that right. don't have annual events. I think Rolapp sees that as a real opportunity and a way to sort of own the summer, because, you know, the NFL pauses. I mean, it seems to own every month, whether they're playing or not, but they see the summer as a chance to really put golf front and center. So, you know, I'm going to be very interested in where we are in 18 months, 24 months.
Yeah, I agree. Ron, as always, thank you for being with us. We appreciate your time and have a great day. And I hope you win your tournament.
Thanks. I'll take all the help I get. I just hope I push him to the 18th hole.
You got it. Thanks, Ron.
You've been listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show with Rich Stiles. Go to Back9Boys.com for all things golf whenever you want it. We'll be back next week with an all-new Back Nine Boys at Back9Boys.com.